So, welcome to CotiCast, the podcast for debate, discussion and analysis of issues related to geriatric and general medicine. So, it's Nick, Christina and Emma today. So, hi everyone.
Hello.
And this is one of our podcasts in the series of what we've learnt this week. So that can be tips that we've taken from the wards, from reading, from Twitter. So I'm on maternity leave at the moment, so I'm not on the wards. So my tip is coming from the BMJ, because I was going through a big stack of them and I found a really good educational part, a 10-minute consultation on acute vertigo, which has got a good infographic that I'll link at the end of the podcast. I don't know how you guys feel when you pick up a patient who's got dizziness on the take.
Yeah, it's a challenging one for me.
Yeah, me too. I think probably because in my head there's so many causes, I'm worried about missing a serious one.
Yeah.
And then at the same time feeling, oh, I can't kind of investigate every single person with an MRI.
Which one can be reassured.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be quite tricky to get the history. So this infographic I found it really useful because it goes through symptoms that you'd elicit in the history and kind of that might point you in a direction of a possible cause, so to think about. So I suppose if we kind of just go through it, one of the causes of vertigo would be a posterior stroke. And what kind of symptoms, if a patient was telling you, would ring alarm bells for you guys kind of to consider a stroke?
So sudden onset would be the one I would think about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's usually long-lasting, isn't it? It doesn't come and go.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Not necessarily positional or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose if they've got any other neurological symptoms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they kind of said, obviously, numbness, weakness, sensory loss, facial numbness. Double vision, and I suppose it's who your patient is. It's hard for us because we're dealing with the elderly, mm-hmm. So they're probably all more at risk of having stroke. But I suppose if they've got any other risk factors, diabetes, mm-hmm. and high blood pressure, high cholesterol, smokers, mm-hmm. And that's, I think the incidence of that is about 18 in 100,000 population for posterior circulation stroke, and that's the one that I'm always scared of missing, mm-hmm. because you don't want to send somebody home.
Yeah,
you don't know, do I need to speak to the stroke consultant, do I need to refer on? So that's the one that I'm always kind of worried about. Do you have any tips when you see people?
No, I think it's looking at the patient as a whole and trying to figure out how this came about, whether they've had it before, their risk factors, and then whether it's come on very, very suddenly or whether it's come on gradually.
Yeah. And one of the other causes, of which we've probably all heard of, is BPPV, and that stands for benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. So unlike when we're discussing a stroke, that is vertigo triggered by a head position. Have you seen that often presenting kind of acutely?
I'm not sure I've seen a case of it before. I mean, I know the sort of quintessential description is the turning over in bed and it comes on suddenly. Either I've not been very good at picking them up or I've just not come across it in my wee career so far.
Yeah, I think I've seen it more in falls and syncope clinics than acute.
Yeah,
I don't know if you think the same.
Well, I think a lot of people who have vertigo, it classically gets better, doesn't it, over a period of a few seconds once they've got out of bed or stopped rolling over, then it's often dealt with in primary care a lot more.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're less exposed to it. But what's really interesting there, I'm just reading over your shoulder, is that it's significantly more common, isn't it? So 600 per 100,000 of the population compared to
18. Yeah.
But you know, my first question whenever I see someone with dizziness is if they've had a stroke, have they had a stroke, whereas actually what you should be looking for is the more common benign. But
then those patients may be the ones that are being filtered out by primary care.
Exactly,
we are seeing a skewed kind of population in the hospital.
So typically it's, as you said, short, comes and goes, it's positional, so triggered by bending, rolling over in bed, looking up. And I was watching or listening to a podcast where someone was talking about vertigo and they said that we should be doing a Dix Hallpike on everyone who comes in with dizziness because it's so common to have BPPV to see if there is any nystagmus there, and I think, oh, that's something I do in falls and syncope clinic, but I don't often do that acutely.
No, I would sometimes do it, but I find
challenging to do. Yeah,
it is challenging to do on, especially in MAU, where it's, you know, and sometimes you're seeing these patients in a chair in a little room on MAU. So, yeah, it's
very tricky. It is tricky. Isn't it?
Yeah.
And then, so some slightly less common, so vestibular migraine, which I must admit I've not really.
I'm pretty sure I've never seen one of those.
No. I've never diagnosed that myself. No. I mean, I'm just reading about it now, really. But yeah, so that would be some classic features of migraine. So a headache, although you can get a headache with stroke as well. Photophobia, phonophobia, and nausea. And their episodes may last minutes to days. And they are also motion sensitive. And they feel tired. Mm. And I suppose they might have a history, previous personal history or family history of migraine. So it's one to consider. Yeah. But potentially in the elderly who've never had a migraine before, it wouldn't probably be top of your list. It would be
to label it that.
Yeah,
it's probably one to label once you've rolled that.
Exactly. Yeah. And then vestibular neuronitis.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What
very
do you think?
I really struggle to differentiate the two, to be honest. Yeah. And I know that the falls and syncope doctors will be cringing at that. But as much as I read about it, or as many talks that I go to, I really struggle to differentiate the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what they say in this infographic is the symptoms that kind of point you into the direction of that might be loss of balance and vomiting. Mm-hmm. And it's confirmed by the presence of horizontal unidirectional nystagmus. So that means that the movement will always be in one direction, irrespective of where the eyes are looking.
Mm.
I do find that quite hard as well.
But I think it's important. The important thing is to look at the history factors there.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's why this is useful, isn't it? Because it's important when you see, instead of getting bogged down in, oh my goodness, there's so many different reasons why they might be dizzy, let's properly take a good history and it might help.
I think this is what this infographic is really highlighting, is the important points to try and elicit from the history.
Exactly.
Not just they're dizzy.
Yeah.
You know, what are the associated symptoms?
Don't jump straight into an examination of a head impulse test.
Exactly. And then obviously there's very rare things like cerebellopontine angle tumour, but you tend to get hearing loss, facial numbness, and it might be progressive kind of hearing loss.
Yeah.
And that's very rare compared to the other causes, but something to consider. But we'll put a link to the infographic, because I thought it was just a really useful visual aid to help you kind of clarify in your mind the different causes of vertigo. And that's, I think, cool. We've got a mini gem called Shake, Rattle and Roll.
Yes.
About BPPV.
Yes, so, and the Epley, yeah.
Yeah, and Epley, so definitely check that out as well.
Absolutely, we can link it, can't we?
Yeah.
Magic.
Great.
Right,
so my, what I've learned this week, again, I'm also on maternity leave, so they're not on the wards, but...
Is it Harry for some McClary? Reason,
for some reason, what came to my mind is, I don't think anyone takes bisphosphonates properly. So I read on NICE a little bit about it and looked into the textbook way that you should take your bisphosphonate tablets. And given that this is a seriously commonly prescribed tablet, alendronate or resedronate, in both primary and secondary care with elderly people, I wonder if anyone, once I read about it, actually does it properly. So I think we know a few of the things, but I'll go through everything. So it must be taken on an empty stomach, as the absorption is affected by food, drink and other drugs, including the calcium supplements, which are probably likely to be concurrently prescribed. So coffee, orange juice, they reduce bioavailability by 60%. So it should be taken before breakfast and 30 minutes before food and tablets. You must not lie down for 30 minutes, so it shouldn't be taken before getting up in the morning. So I imagine quite a lot of elderly people need to take their painkillers or any other medication before they get out of bed in the morning. So how they can, you know, manage to take a tablet upright 30 minutes before any other tablet, food or drink, I imagine is quite challenging. and difficulty complying with or following these instructions, an alternative medication or formulation may need to be looked into. In the example of the patient that needs painkillers to get out of bed, or is PD taking meds, medication, PD meds or medication that needs you to have a full stomach, or you know, patients on I don't know how they manage when they're on calcium supplements as well. It just, I don't think I could do it.
No, absolutely not.
Another important point I wanted to mention was just to always bear in mind that previous GI ulcer surgery or esophageal problems contraindicate bisphosphonates, so they are important to think about. And also maintaining good oral hygiene with regular dental checkups and informing dentists that you are on this medication. Those are things that I perhaps am not that consistent at relaying to patients and their relatives as well, because obviously not always the patient manages the medication.
And that's for osteonecrosis, isn't it?
That's what they, I remember in an osteoporosis clinic that I went to, the consultant asked me, what are their teeth like? And it's, you know, it's an important factor to haven't really thought about it. But it comes back to the point that we prescribe these things for patients, but we don't give them the advice.
No, it's terrible. Yeah. We do. I'm definitely guilty of not telling someone how to take their medication.
Yeah.
And if they can't take it 30 minutes before anything else, first thing in the morning, it has to be either 2 hours after or 2 hours before anything else. So they need a 4-hour window, but they're not going to eat, drink, or take any medication.
It really does make you realise why, you know, people struggle to be compliant with the medication, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, no wonder.
I do no fault of their own,
That's good to get that.
Good learning point for all of us, I think.
Yeah. Need to tell our patients about taking medication, how to take it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right, I've learned a little bit this week. And how comfortable are we dealing with symptom control as an inpatient at the end of life? Relatively comfortable?
I feel like something I am, but on a case-by-case basis, I could become more challenging.
Sure, but we get a lot of good teaching. There's a lot of good resources. Yeah. There's palliative care nurses who can help us with end-of-life care, and I think that generally, you know, we do it quite well as an inpatient.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How about disease-specific diseases at the end of life? So I'm talking a little bit about diabetes in particular. Yeah. What do we do?
Tricky, because you don't want
You get a very different opinion from geriatrician versus diabetologist versus palliative care.
Exactly. Which is why it would be good to have a good resource out there, wouldn't there? And there is.
Brilliant.
Yes. And we can link it. Tell us more. Thank you. Good segue. So the North of England Cancer Network palliative and end-of-life care guidelines is something that is easily accessible via Google, and post a link.
I use them
all the time because the palliative care nurses give us them in booklet form, don't they?
Yeah. Is that the yellow book?
Yes, it's the yellow book.
Used to be purple. No.
Yeah.
I have one in my bag, so I just all the time on call and everything.
Okay, there's a lovely flowchart here for patients with diabetes as they're approaching the last few days of life. Okay, so what do you do if someone has got type 2 diabetes that is diet controlled?
Stop checking their blood sugars.
Yes, you can stop checking their blood sugars. And you can indeed discuss it with the patient and the patient's relatives, especially. And there's also, if they're on metformin, or if they've perhaps got some symptoms to suggest diabetes, then you could agree with the patient to decide whether you're going to do a random BM or a urine dipstick, which might be less invasive, and have a look. And then you could make a decision to see if they've got more 2+ of, if they've got 2+ or more of glucose, then you could check a BM. Which would be really interesting, and you could, you could add in some oral treatments then, depending on what the results are. So, what about if they've got diabetes and they're on a sulfonylurea?
I suppose they'd be more at risk of hypoglycemic events if they're not eating as much towards the end of life.
Tailor it to current diet.
Tailor it to diet, and you could if they've got no hypoglycemia symptoms, then you could have a little look at the dose of the medications as well, dose of the glucosides. But if there's no hypoglycemia, you could think about changing to you could think about changing to insulin if needs be, and there's a really good tool there for how to change to insulin.
That's interesting, yeah.
What about insulin-controlled diabetes?
Oh, this is the one where I dread.
I suppose it would depend if they are type 1 or type 2. Type 1 will have had a lifetime of checking and giving insulin, and taking that away actually might be a huge upheaval at the end of life, and it might be important to them and their family to continue. Type 2, I mean, if there's a dietary element, if their food intake's massively going down, their insulin requirement might be going down. So I would probably seek advice of the diabetes
exactly.
You don't want to do more harm that they hypo or they go into DKA, but you don't want it to be symptomatic.
Which could be a stressing condition.
Yeah, exactly.
But you don't want to do blood sugar tests all the time.
I know, look, it's so difficult, and I'm not going to go through the nitty gritty because it's quite, there are lots of very good instructions out there, but basically, you need to tailor it to each patient.
Yeah.
All right, so we tailor the patient's care depending on their symptoms and their wishes, and then we also use the resources available to us, like the palliative care nurses and the diabetes nurses. But phenomenal resource, because it just makes things a little bit clearer, doesn't it? Because it's such a hazy area.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So that was, I thought, was really interesting.
We'll add a link for that resource onto the end of this podcast. That's a really good one, I think, actually. I'm going to look that up. So finally, I thought I'd just do a second one
bonus.
Restless leg syndrome. I wonder if our GP colleagues are much more comfortable dealing with this than we are in secondary care. I mean, I see 100%. On people's problem list, but I must admit, I don't probably go into it that much.
No. The Parkinson's specialist doctors deal with it quite regularly, don't they?
Yeah.
But it's not something I'm comfortable with whatsoever.
So I was just reading that it's estimated a prevalence of 10 to 35% in individuals over 65. So it's quite common. And they think it may be due to reduced dopamine response or dopamine levels in the central nervous system. Most causes are idiopathic, but do you know of any other... Or is there anything that you've come across or have heard that can cause it, which kind of is a secondary cause? There's some surprising ones here, I thought.
What about...
Some sort of vitamin or mineral deficiency.
Vitamin D, is it? No, B12.
So,
stop guessing.
Iron deficiency. Uremia, which I think I remember from my renal job. When I say I think I remember. apparently folate deficiency and some drugs. Phenytoin, amitriptyline, beta blockers,
lithium,
which
I didn't think.
But iron deficiency anemia was the one that surprised me. So just to recap, restless legs is a desire to move limbs associated with paresthesia. It's made worse by rest, so often people get up and walk around in the night if they have it to try and relieve it. It's a motor restlessness, and the symptoms are obviously worse at night. But you should be checking a ferritin level on people who have restless legs.
Very interesting.
You should be investigating why they've got iron deficiency anemia if you find one. And actually, it recommends supplementing, giving them iron supplements if their ferritin's 50 or less. So that's not necessarily would put you, it's on the lower end, but not kind
it's
of
not
in
the
diagnostic.
Guidelines. Yeah, absolutely.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
So you should be doing that before you start any of the first line treatments, the medical treatments, which are kind of rapinerol. Or
I know, and they, I mean, there's side effects.
Yeah, exactly.
So conservative measures first, yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I don't think I would have done that before, but now I will.
Yes.
Yeah.
Top tip. Excellent.
Yeah.
Good one.
I think that's all we've got for today. So thank you very much for listening. And you'll be able to find this podcast on iTunes and the website at www.amy.org.uk. And our Twitter handle is @elderlymeded. And we'd love any feedback or if you've got any future topics that you want us to talk about. Thank you so much.
Thanks.